Okay, so today is Friday, the 28th of December, 2018. It is the Chaf, the 20th day of Teves, Tavshin Ayin Tes, and we are finishing off the first parak of Shlach. Now, there's a little bit of a problem with the first parak of Shlach, and that is it's very much combined and integrated with the second parak of Shlach. So you don't want to like spill the beans too much on what comes up on the second parak, but a couple of things just want to we'll point out over the course of this parak to discuss. So number one is who these people were. Who were these people? Actually, what was the plan? Let's start with that. What was the plan? What was the purpose of sending the spies into the land of Israel? So as we pointed out the other day, so there seems to be a machlukas rishonim, machlukas amongst the meforshim as to what was the original sin with regards to sending out the spies. So the impression that we're supposed to get with regard from Rashi is, and I think that's what he gives, is that already from the beginning that this was a doomed plan, that Bnei Yisrael should have had no reason to send anybody in, and Moshe should have had no reason to agree, and they did. And Hashem says, Shlach, even though our parsha opens up with Hashem seemingly having the idea originating from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, really it was, right away Rashi says, Shlach Na, send those people that you want to send. I don't want to, it's not my job, it's your job, you're the one who has Bechira Chavshis, and you're able to go. So we saw that there's a different attitude within the Ramban. The Ramban, the beginning of the parak over there, seems to say, no, it seems like it was pretty legitimate. He raises a whole bunch of kashas, a whole bunch of issues with regards to that understanding. Five questions he brings up. If that was the case, was this Moshe's sin also? If it was Moshe's sin, so Moshe should have had the same punishment that the Bnei Israel had, maybe. I mean, Ramban doesn't go that far. But he says, we don't seem to see that Moshe shoulders any of the blame over the course of this story. And B, that it sounds kind of reasonable that they were supposed to go. So the Rav Soloveitchik has an essay, well, not really an essay, one from the Rav Thinking Aloud. So he has an interesting piece where he seems to take the Ramban as a granted, that he seems to assume that their job was to go and see the land of Israel, and there was an appropriateness to it. Where does he talk about here? So he says, well, first of all, the term meraglim is not found in the parsha. We call it the chait of the meraglim, but we don't actually see that word come up over the course of the parsha. What is the term that is used over the course of the parsha to describe what they're going to be doing in the land of Israel?
Spy.
Well, that's the English term. It says lasur, lasur es haaretz, in order to see the land, in order to go and get an understanding of the land. What's the difference between regel and tour? Regel is talking really spying. So even though Arsko might translate it as spy, Rav Soloveitchik is pointing out that there's a distinction there.
Didn't regel walk the land? Regel is to walk.
Yeah, how does he know that? How did he know that? Well, we call it the Chait HaMeraglim. I believe the Gemara calls it that. That's sort of the not such good understanding. The Ragel is more military in nature, as opposed, at least Rav Soloveitchik's proposal is that the Ragel is a military mission, as opposed to Lasur is a sightseeing mission. So, right, so they were specifically being told that you're going to go and do a sightseeing mission rather than a military mission. Now, where do we see that more than just with regards to the words? So the instruction, the very instructions that Moshe gives is not where are their strongholds and where are their booby traps and where are their, where do their spies hang out and what are their military plans. Rather, it's go see the land, whether it's good, whether it's fruitful, whether it in fact has a milk and honey coming out of it. That is the that is what Moshe was requesting. That is the information that they were requesting. Now, there is also, he also requested, are they powerful or are they not? But three of the four questions have to do with the land, as opposed to the last one, which in the last one is not necessarily about strategic information. Rather, it's just, are they good? Right? What's their ranking? Not about how specifically are we going to go ahead and attack. Right, but that's not necessarily a strategic assessment. It could be interpreted that way, but at least the point is that still most of the questions that he asked had to do more about the land than it did about the military issues. So why was that? So why did he send them? What was the purpose of this? So Rav Soloveitchik's suggestion is that there is a din in terms of hilchos, people getting married to one another. Then aser la'adam, the Gemara tells us aser la'adam shiyakadish es ha'isha ad shiyarena. The one is prohibited from being mekadish a woman until he sees them. That person has to actually make that connection. Now, I'm not sure that Gemara is not ma'akev. I mean, even though you're not supposed to do it, it could be done, right? There is such a thing as kedushi ayude shliach and things like that, I don't think it's ma'akev, but when it's saying usher, what it's telling you is don't do it, right? Don't get married without first seeing who the spouse is going to be. Now, how much time? So, what is the source of that? Let's start with that. What is the where does that come from? That where do we see that a couple would not get married until they actually met one another, even though it was arranged and there was a good shachin involved?
Yitzchak.
Good, yeah, Yitzchak. That's the example that he gives. That Eliezer brings Rivka back, and Eliezer tells Yitzchak that everything is wonderful, but yet Yitzchak still had to bring Rivka into the camp. Yivieha Yitzchak avoleha, that he brings Yitzchak, he brings Rivka into the camp. And what was the test? There was a test there. Anybody remember what that was?
Water.
No, that was the test with Eliezer and Rivka. But even Yitzchak put a test. There was some type of determination. This is not in the text itself, but there is a midrashic Rashi quotes it. Vas?
Not the candles.
Yes, the candles. What was the story with the candles?
They stayed lit in Sarah's tent.
Yeah.
But then they went out when Sarah died.
Right.
And so when
did they? How long did they stay lit for?
From week to week.
Right? From week to week, right? Meaning that they were relit. They relit for Shabbos, right? That's the assumption. They relit for Shabbos, and they stayed on for the rest of the week. They probably had like a twisting thing on top, like a kosher cover, so that they could go to sleep. But other than that, the candles were going the entire time, right? So when you read that pasuk, even if you want to buy into that he brought her into the tent, and this is Rashi makes the point, this is before Kedusha, before Nisun, this is before they got married, this was the date. Now, how long a date was it? So when you read it, and I think the way we kind of, when you read it as a fourth grader learning Parshas Chayisara, so the interpretation, the understanding you get is, oh, this is very fast. This is like one of these Hasidisha things where they get together, they meet for half an hour, and so instead of them meeting for half an hour and talking about the weather, they met for half an hour and talked about candles, right? Or saw the candle light for a really long time. All of a sudden, candle went on, and we're supposed to be very impressed by this. So each point, thanks. So wait a second. For that medrash to make sense, she had to have been there an entire week. Right, so that already is a much longer than the Hasidim take in order to get engaged. Right? It was an entire week, the whole date. You know, he got to show her all of Beis Lechem or wherever it is that they're meeting up. What?
She was only 3 years old.
No, at that point was she still 3 years old? At that point, or was time supposed to pass? I mean, she might have been four. It's a little older. It's a good question. First of all, the idea that she's 3 years old, I mean, we understand that based on, even more than a marriage, I think they do a cheshbon about the years that is being described. But is that.
She brought water and all that?
Yeah, that's. You're supposed to have that reaction.
Small bucket.
Right. So, anyways, however you understand the age aspect to it, we'll push that to the side. So it took a while in order for them to be able to assume that this is going to be charged. Now, why, right? Why? What is the reason for this? Right? We could trust Eliezer. Eliezer is a good guy. Eliezer says this is a good girl for you, so that should be enough, right? He told her everything that he had met already. Why is that not enough? So, because he, so Rav Soloveitchik says, marriage is not an ordinary conception, it is not just a civil commitment or utilitarian mundane partnership, it is an existential commitment, a personalistic covenant. The souls of two lonely people join, two strangers decide to unite destinies, to share in the same fate, to keep together, suffer together, rejoice together, travel together, and pay the toll of the road jointly. In order to make take on such an all-inclusive, all-encompassing commitment, one cannot trust anybody. One must know to whom he dedicates his life intimately and well. Meaning the man has to know the woman, and the woman has to know the man. So when it comes to going into Eretz Yisrael, so that is a similar type of connection. And Israel is going to join with Eretz Yisrael, so to speak, in establishing their destinies together. That's what's going to happen. So in order for Bnei Yisrael to be appropriately ready to enter the land of Israel, so who were they, what do they need to do? They had to, so to speak, date the land. They had to know what they were getting into. Therefore, they had to know a little bit more about the land. So he explains a little bit more. He says, yeah, and therefore, that's the purpose of these 12 people. In fact, we read in the Mefarshim the other day that when they sent spies, it was like, okay, we'll find our crack, our best 2-3 spies, and we're going to send in. And Hashem is the one who told him, no, you need to send a member of each tribe. What was the purpose of sending a member of each tribe? So the way I think the Ramban said was this way, we're going to share the blame amongst all of Klal Yisrael. Rav Soloveitchik says that way there was a representative of all of the people. In fact, that's why all the people are punished for this, because they sent their representatives of all the people in order to be able to establish that connection. And that finally explains what the questions were. The questions were not about the conquering the land. The questions were about getting to know the land. How are they going to conquer it? Well, they'll conquer it by, because Hashem is in charge, and Hashem will be able to run everything for them, and all that's going to be okay. That you can have emunah in, that you can have trust in, especially at this time. But even with all that emunah, even with all that trust, there is still an important ideal that they get to know the land. So this is a very interesting idea, first of all, because it's a totally different perspective as to how we're used to thinking of it, because we normally think of these spies were already plotting bad things from the beginning, and the original problem was that they decided to go all together. So this is really taking a completely different approach. And Rav Soloveitchik doesn't even acknowledge it. He's like, yeah, this is the pshat. All right, read the Ramban, and that's the way to go. That all of that was good. Where did things go bad? So as we pointed out in the Ramban says it all turned around when they got up to that word epis, that everything is good. It's a land flowing with milk and honey, and it's got beautiful fruit and all of that, but we're not going to be able to conquer. We're not going to be able to achieve that. Fine. So that is thought number one. A little bit out there, but now we're going to go a little bit closer. There is in the book that I talked about a couple of weeks ago. Good so far. The book that I quoted a couple of weeks ago from Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein's Sefer on Moshe. So his take is all about, especially starting from the idea of Eldad and Medad, which is in the previous parak, is a take of how are we passing on from one generation to the next. How is that going to take place? So he's back into our world of that they really, was it really necessary in order to go, in order to send somebody in the first place? Was that really appropriate? Fine. But it's probably not. So he takes the question of, so who were these people? Who were these 12 people that were being sent in? So how many of them do we recognize? How many of their names do we know of going in? So not even Caliph. Yehoshua is the only one, I believe. Right, going into the story, the only name that we are familiar with is Yehoshua. But yet, at the same time, what are we also told? We're also told that these were great people. So who are these great people that we had never heard of? So his take is that this was represented the new generation of leadership. These were the people that in order to appease the next generation, the younger people were like, how is this going to work for us?
These weren't the princes or whatever. Were they princes or tribes?
They were, but they were the young princes. I mean, they had to be. They had. We needed people of stature. We need people of stature in order.
Right?
What?
No, they're all dead.
They're not dead yet. They're not dead yet. Yeah.
Still in the first year?
Yeah, but he explains, until now the leadership echelon had come from the elders who led the people in Egypt and through the Exodus. Now, however, in response to the criticisms of Eldad and Medad about the need for younger leaders, Moshe decides to appoint men from Yeshua's generation to spy out the land. In place of Nachshon, the senior leader of the older generation, comes Kalev, right? Nachshon was the leader of from Yehuda, and now there's Kalev, who's young. The same holds true with the other Rishvatim, that out goes the names of the Nasiim that we have already quoted, that we quoted in Parshas Bamidbar and Parshas Naso. And now we have new leaders whose names are listed them. So now, what is their goal? So their goal, in fact, the Chumash tells us that you're supposed to see the land. This pasuk, good fast. Just see this. So what was the goal as is assigned over the course of the parsha? So over Salvechik has thing in order to get to, in order to appreciate, to know what they were getting into. But the truth is, that's not so off. It's obviously not off, but it's not so distinct from what, if you look at the text, that's what it says. Now, what are we doing? First, Perek Yud Gimel Yud Ches. Here we go. Right, Resemes Aretz Mahi. You're going to see the land. V'yasamu Yishev Alech Zaku Rafah Matu Imrav Uma Aretz. And the people that are on it, are they strong? Are they weak? Uma Aretz Ashehu Yishev Batu Vahim Rav Maharim Ashehu Yishev Behena Habemachanim Imbemifserin. So these are all of the questions. So there seem to be two things that we're trying to find out. Number one is, what is the land like? And B, what is the military makeup of the opposition? So in order to resolve those two questions, in order to make everything okay going forward, there need to be two answers that are brought forth. Number one is, yeah, the land is good. And number two, we're going to be able to go in and we're going to be able to conquer them. The answer came back, well, the land is really good, but we're not going to be able to go ahead and conquer them. So he suggests that that is only because the younger group is not used to it. Now, I have a little bit of a problem with that because we're not so far removed from the miracles of leaving Egypt. But that's that's the way he writes. Now, that's a little bit of a weakness in Rav Lichtenstein's take here. Because, you know, we're not talking about such a large age gap about what they saw and what they didn't see. But his suggestion is that the elder group would have been able to come back in the affirmative and say, oh yeah, we'll be able to conquer it, no problem. Right? We crossed the Yam Suf, we got out of Egypt, we had all those plagues, we'll be able to cross it, no problem. The younger group was not able to be so sure about it. I understand, right, that's the kasha. I hear the question, I'm telling you what he said. I understand. I hear the question. That's the. But if it would be the older people that are going to come and tell them, oh, everything's going to be okay and Hashem's going to be able to conquer it, etc., so the people wouldn't have been able to have a positive reaction. People would have been like, oh yeah, well, you know, they say everything is possible, but you know, what do they know already anymore? So that is the. That is the challenge that was here, and it didn't work out. Now, one other thing that he points out is an interesting response with regards to Kalev and Yehoshua. So we learned Pas Parak Yud Gimel already. I think in Yud Dalet Yehoshua does speak up, and Yud Gimel Yehoshua hasn't said anything yet, right? We know that Yehoshua is on the side of Kalev. Kalev jumps up over the course of the discussion here and fights back, says everything's going to be okay, and Yehoshua doesn't. So what is the difference? And then, what else? There's another distinction between Yehoshua and Kalev. What's the distinction between Yehoshua and Kalev? Now, this is already jumping ahead a little bit, but what is their reward? You know what their rewards are?
Yeshua takes over,
right. Yeshua's going to be the next leader. What's Kalev's reward?
Well, he goes into the land.
He does go into the land. What else? He gets a favored section of the land. Right? He gets Hebron, he gets that specific area. So Kalev has, so they both have, they have different reactions, and they have different rewards. In fact, we don't even see that they're necessarily in cahoots, right? They have two different, they seem to be working on two completely different planes. What are the different planes? What?
They're in different places. The Kalev goes to Hebron.
Right. Right, well, it's just something that seems to say that Yeshua didn't do it. Right, so they seem to be operating on different levels here. So what are those different levels? So Yehoshua is, and Yeshua's reward is that he's going to be, the next leader of the Jewish people. Again, that's his reward. So how does he react to this problem? So at this point, all we have is silence from Yehoshua. right? What's Kalev's reaction? Kalev's reaction is he fights back. Now, is he successful in his fighting back? No, it seems like he's not successful, right? Do we have another example of that, where we have two people, Bnei Yisrael is doing really bad things, two people there's two people that seem to defend Bnei Yisrael, one of them fights back, and one of them doesn't seem to really fight back. Very good. At the Eagle, we have a very good parallel. Hur fights back. What happens to Hur?
They kill him,
right? What happens to Aaron? So nothing happens to Aaron. But on the other hand, Aaron is perceived as being weak, right? You read Parshas Ki Tisa, you scratch your head saying, what's up with Aaron? I think we spent a lot of time on that when we learned it. What's Aaron doing here with regards to this situation?
What about Korach and Moshe? Korach wanted his own people in there. He was complaining.
Okay.
Like Moshe won out and Korach fell into the ground.
All right, no, that's true. But I'm pointing out with these two are considered favored. They're both. In both of those situations, both of those pairs are considered good guys. You recognize both as tzaddikim, but the one who fights back harshly, in Hur's case, gets killed. And in Kalev's case, isn't just, well, at least as far as we know at this point, isn't successful in his being able to fight back. In those two cases, the other two people, Aaron and Yehoshua, even though at that point seem to not be pushing back so hard, ultimately, they're seen as greater leader characters for Bnei Yisrael.
A distinction because Hur was of the younger generation, and Aaron was of the older generation. So, at that point, the older generation was meant to lead. Now, in the instance of Caleb and Yeshua, it was the younger generation that was destined to lead. Caleb was from the older generation. It makes sense that each one would be designated as the leader in that specific timing.
How does that fit in with the fact that Caleb was of the didn't have the?
Yeah, you got to work that out a little bit more.
Caleb had experience.
Caleb
was older than Moshe.
Where do we see him? Where do we see him doing anything?
Okay.
It's the opposite. But he's saying it is the opposite. So you have to. Okay. All right.
But it makes sense because.
Well, which one makes sense?
Both. They both do because in the first instance, for the younger generation, for Hur to be the leader, it didn't make any sense because they were just.
Okay.
But here, they don't designate the younger generation to take over. It doesn't make sense for somebody older than Caleb.
But there's no pattern. The patterns are is the opposite. So you gotta.
No, the pattern is that the younger generation was meant to was best.
No, but in both cases, the person stepped in, was Mekadish Hashem, so to speak, stood up for HaKadosh Baruch Hu and was a zealot against the crowd. In both cases, wasn't successful. So one could say, well, you could be older and younger and still do that. In neither case, you'll be successful. That's okay if you want to explain it that way. But but it's not relevant. I mean, the age is not relevant to that situation, to that description. So what's Kalev's reward then? Kalev's reward is he gets a personal gain. In fact, Kalev's appearance in Yehoshua, when he has a discussion, what's his appearance in Yehoshua about? His appearance in Yehoshua is not tapping Yehoshua on the shoulder and saying, Yehoshua, remember, I'm supposed to get the land near Hebron. Right? That's his job, and making sure that his kids get married and making sure that his family is established. He goes back into being the personal group. He stood up, he made his stand for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but ultimately is not going to be leadership material. Same thing with Hur. He made a stand for HaKadosh Baruch Hu and didn't work. Right, a leader has to be able to manage that thing. But there is often a necessity for that. And we're not saying that that's a bad guy. There is often a necessity for that person to be sort of the zealot, even though the leadership is going to come from somebody perhaps more in the middle. So, for example, if one wants to listen, Rabbi Przanski recently gave a talk. He's been doing talks on the great rabbinic leaders of the 20th century, on condition that they're dead by now. That was the rule. So he gave one recently on Rav Meir Kahana, which is fascinating. Anybody ever meet Rav Meir Kahana? No?
Mayor Kana?
Mayor Kana, yeah. Hashem Yikom Damam. You met him?
Oh, met him now.
No. So his brother, by the way, is still alive. His brother is the rabbi of the young Israel of the Old City, which is, as I know, the Old City. If you know where like Israelite is, or like how to get to Isha Torah, I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you continue on that road, it's like a narrow road. If you continue on that road, make sure you don't go too far on that road. If you continue on that road, there is a small building there. It says a sign on it, the youngest of the Old City. The last I was there, because I spent, I was in Israel when I was a rabbi in Phoenix. I was around the youngest old Phoenix. So I went and said hello to him. Hi, I'm also a youngest old rabbi. Perhaps one very, very far away from where you are. So his brother's still, his brother's also the author of Sfarim on Tosfos, the Mei Menuchos. But anyways, Remeir Kahana was not willing to negotiate. I mean, he was constantly protesting. He was constantly raising the flag and constantly attempting to be Mekadesh Hashem. But the leadership couldn't, like, that's where the leadership was. But often you need people like that in order to, you know, in order to start the conversation or to add things into the conversation. So Przanski's connection pointed out that it's similar to the machlokas between the Irgun and the Haganah in the state in the days before the state. I mean, both of them had problems with each other. Everybody knew the Haganah was larger and stronger, the more centered, etc. But if the Irgun wasn't doing what they were doing, if Menachem Begin wasn't doing what he was doing, so who knows if the state would have ever been formed by the Irgun. Right, by the Haganah, right? Who knows if that would have ever worked out? So you need those different levels, ultimately, leadership is the person in the middle who's able to work things out.
I don't see how being silent is showing leadership.
We're not done yet, right? The story I pointed out in the beginning. We're not done with the story. There is Perek Yudalet as well. I believe Yeshua comes in then. One more point along these lines, and that is just the regular way that we understand, or perhaps the way that most that we've accustomed to understand Shlach, is that what were these people? These people were such great people. What was the reason for sinning, the spies, etc.? And famously, Rabbi Simon here quoted from Rabbi Yaakov Goldberg, Chaim Yaakov Goldberg, etc., the idea that they were living completely spiritual lives, and they were afraid to risk that. They were afraid that, you know, at this point they're living on mun. They don't have to worry about all these things in the desert. They get to learn Torah all day. All of the materialistic things in the world are not concerns for them. And that's good in its own right. And B, there is a fear that once it does become a risk for them, this the spirituality that they've been able to achieve is not going to be able to continue. So what was their mistake then? The mistake is that the ideal is to be able to bring that into the world, to be able to not just live spiritually in the desert and be Gemalchus Kohanim v'Goy Kadosh out there in the desert, but to be able to formulate a country and be able to be a Mekadesh Hashem for the rest of the world. He describes that there is two different ideals with regards to Torah. What was that here? Yeah, that Rav Shlomo Kahaneman pointed out that there's two psukim that describe the gift of Torah. One is Torah Tzivalana Moshe Marashah Kiles Yaakov. That's one. And then the Atak Kisfu Lachem Es Hashira Zos at the very end of the Dvarim. So there is idea of Torah and a Marasha and the idea that we are sanctified, connected specifically to Torah. But Torah is also described as a Shira. And the term Shira is used that Torah isn't just strictly what we learn in the Beis Medrash, but it's also how it impacts the rest of our lives. And that's ultimately the goal. The goal is not that we just be impacted by Torah while in the Beis Medrash to the point that we're afraid to leave the Beis Medrash because Torah will then lose its impact, but rather that Torah be able to impact and become a shir and be able to influence not us, our lives outside technically the Beis Medrash, and even as we grow and build the country, that Torah continue to influence that as well, and that be able to be a song that not just we'll be able to experience, but that the entire world will be able to recognize. Okay, let's stop here. Guten Shabbos.
Shabbos.